9:25 p.m. November 15, 2018. Jesse Brown VA Medical Center, Chicago, Illinois. They went into the hospital through the loading bay. Wearing scrubs, their hair changed. The idea was to avoid anyone scanning the monitors, whether they were normal security or working for the head. Matilda wasn't sure if they were distinguishable anyway. Koto pulled the van in while Dr. Song and Matilda unloaded the comatose Nulls. It didn't take long before security showed up, a guard doing the rounds, a flashlight at his hip beside a gun that had likely never been drawn. He rapped a knuckle on the windshield of the van.
"No loading here, bud," the guard said. "You need to move."
Koto rolled down the window.
"Sorry, what?"
The guard, getting pissed, practically stuck his head in the driver's side window.
"I said..."
he began. He stopped short when Koto pressed Dr. Song's taser into his neck. The guard's knees buckled, he fell backward, where Childers caught him. She lowered him to the ground and bound him with the rope. She also took his ID badge. Childers gave a thumbs up to Koto. The badge opened a door to a supply room. They were in. Wearing the proper garb and pushing three comatose patients, Matilda, Koto, and Childers looked like they belonged. Even with Ashanik trailing behind with Dr. Song, none of the nurses and techs they passed blinked an eye.
"There is an elevator to the left," Dr. Song directed. "We'll need my badge."
Two elevator rides and 1,500 feet of hallway later, they approached the doors to the room that housed the head Linux machine. An armed security guard sat at a small desk to the left of the room. He looked up at them, his face illuminated by the tablet in his hands. Recognizing them immediately, the guard jumped up. The tablet clattered to the floor. He drew his weapon and, without word, began firing. A window to Kojo's left exploded. He dived to the ground, pulling his sidearm, as Matilda and Dr. Song guided the comatose Nulls toward the wall. Ashanik scrambled behind Matilda, her heart racing. The sound of the shots reverberated around the hallway, like boxed-in explosions. The guard kept shooting as he walked fearlessly toward them. A ceiling light burst over Matilda's head. Hot shards of glass rained down into her hair. Dr. Song cried out as a bullet tore through his left foot. Koto steadied his weapon and fired once. The bullet screamed into the guard's forehead, sending him spinning to the tiled floor, where he twitched once before lying still. Koto ran over to Matilda and Ashanik.
"You okay? Anyone hit?"
Matilda, Childers, and Ashanik were uninjured. Amazingly, Terry, Alice, and Hugh remained unharmed as well. Dr. Song stood and steadied himself, trying not to put weight on his foot. Childers looked the wound over.
"I'll live," Dr. Song said. "We need to get inside."
Koto shot out a video camera over the guard's small desk as Dr. Song scanned his badge on the reader next to the door. It beeped, but did not unlock. Dr. Song tried it again, but again it failed. He turned back to look at Childers, shaking his head.
"I don't understand," he began.
He stopped when he noticed Ashanik pulling the badge from the dead guard's belt. She stepped up beside him and calmly held the badge to the reader. There was a metallic clank as the door unlocked. They made their way inside quickly. The door closed and locked behind them before Dr. Song flipped on the lights. The Linac was revealed. Ashanik walked across the room to look closely at the machine. It reminded her of a squat telescope and seemed to hover 8 feet over the floor. It was bigger than the one she'd seen in her mind, sleeker, recalling the one her mother had been subjected to and how loud it was. Ashanik wondered what sort of sound this one was going to make.
"Ashanik," Dr. Song said, "please, we don't have much time."
He pointed to a whiteboard opposite the Linux machine before Childers eased him into a chair. As Ashanik walked over to the board, she noticed that Dr. Song had made bloody left shoe prints around the room.
"Can you write it out for us?" Dr. Song said.
Ashanik grabbed a dry erase marker from the shelf on the whiteboard and took the cap off the marker. As everyone watched, unconsciously holding their breath, Ashanik began to write. She began to cover the whiteboard with symbols. Next to them, she wrote numbers. And then beside those, she wrote another series of symbols.
Incredible, Dr. Song said.
Dr. Song was desperate to believe that this would be his absolution. He had long dreamed of the moment he'd see the solution. Even more, he often lay awake at night, imagining how he'd use the resulting code to program the Linux and cure Terry, Alice, and Hugh. It was a video he had played and reversed over and over during decades of long nights in dozens of dank basements. Curing the null would maybe erase his past crimes. Dr. Song imagined the hate, the bitterness would be washed away, like caked on mud. Then when Terry, Alice, and Hugh had been cured, he would find the others. He would walk every continent if he had to. And when that was accomplished, when the madness had finally vanished, then maybe, just maybe, he would feel good enough about himself to wish for a normal life, a life he didn't think he'd ever deserve again. At 60, he knew he still had time left to begin again, time enough to forge a new soul. As Ashanik covered the whiteboard with symbols, letters, and numbers, Dr. Song was stunned to see she was using Dr. Tyriol's handwriting. Watching it in real time, he realized Ashanik wasn't channeling the intellect of a dead woman. She was reaching into the depths of a mind that stretched into infinity. For all intents and purposes, Ashanik was Dr. Tyriol, just as she was Janelle. Alarms began to sound outside the room. Dr. Song knew the guard's body had likely been discovered. The door to the lab would be kicked in within a few minutes' time. Ashanik ignored the blares of the sirens and kept writing. She finished 20 seconds later and turned around. There it is, she said. Dr. Song pulled the photocopied journal pages from his back pocket. He unfolded them and began to translate the passages in his mind, scribbling with a pencil on the margins of the pages.
Amazing, he mumbled. Doctor, Kojo said, eyeing the door. We don't have much time.
Dr. Song looked up at the whiteboard. He knew this process might take an hour, possibly even longer. He was going to suggest they barricade themselves in, prepare to be overrun. But he didn't, because Ashanik put her hands on the Linux control panel and turned on the machine. You don't need to decipher it now, she said. I can do this.
You remember it all? Dr. Song asked, stunned.
Yes. Matilda touched Ashanik's arm. Are you ready? No, she said. I don't want to lose them. I know what they knew. My mother, my grandmother. All those other lives, they're a part of me. I don't want to give them up. If I do, they'll be gone forever. Silent the same way as they are with everyone else.
Behind them, the Linux machine came online. It buzzed and rattled. Metal knocked against metal, loud enough that Dr. Song was surprised the comatose nulls didn't startle in their endless sleep.
Put Terry beneath the machine, Ashanik said.
Childers wheeled Terry under the Linux and put the brakes on his wheelchair. She looked up into the dark eye of the machine. Ashanik asked everyone to take a step back. They did.
I don't want you to be accidentally exposed, she said.
Just before the test was activated, the door to the room swung open. Raid stepped inside and shot Terry in the chest. Blood blossomed under Terry's shirt. The force was enough to knock him out of the wheelchair. His head hit the linoleum floor with a sad, hollow sound. Raid turned to the other two comatose nulls and shot them both as well. Alice and Hugh were blown backward, and their locked wheelchairs overturned. The tiny front wheels turned in useless silence as the echoes of the gunshots faded.
No one move, Raid said.
That's when Kojo saw the worst thing he'd seen in all his decades as a cop. Every other horror, every awful act humankind was capable of. None of it compared to the sight of Raid holding a Sig Sauer P-938 handgun to his son's head. Brandon was beyond crying.
his face was a sheet of pure terror. His eyes seemed enveloped in psychic pain.
Drop the gun, Raid said.
Okay, okay.
Kojo carefully pulled his revolver from his belt and laid it on the floor. Then he kicked it over to Raid. Raid stepped on it with his left foot. Brandon squirmed and moaned. Raid looked over at Ashanik, then turned to Matilda and Childers.
Empty your pockets, Raid ordered.
Matilda, Childers, and Ashanik turned their pockets inside out. Satisfied, Raid let go of Brandon and pushed the boy to Kojo. Brandon collapsed in his father's arms. Kojo held him close as Raid walked across the room to the whiteboard. He looked over at Ashanik's work, studying it carefully. With Raid briefly preoccupied, Childers looked around for a weapon, any weapon. She saw a scalpel in a pocket of a lab coat on a hook 2 feet away. She plucked the scalpel from the coat and removed its protective plastic sheath. Kojo noticed and shook his head. Childers put a finger to her lips.
Shh.
61. Ray turned the sixth sour on Dr. Song.
Does it work?
We were just readying the first test.
Hurry up.
Raid stepped toward Dr. Song just as Childers ran at him with the scalpel. She'd had enough. Seeing the null shot down so helpless broke something inside her. As she ran, Childers thought back to when she was in the ER after being jumped by some creeps near the train tracks. While they bandaged her up, she watched a junkie come in practically dead. But the doctor grabbed an AED and jolted the junkie's chest. Her body danced before the junkie bolted right up, mouth wide open and eyes bugging out, like she'd just seen the four horsemen ride past her. Whatever the AED did, Childers felt its organic equivalent, an uncanny boost that turned into a killing machine. Raid clearly wasn't expecting her to be so bold. He swung toward Childers just in time to get a scalpel across the cheek. The narrow blade cut a thin line through the subcutaneous fat. It was deep enough that it tinged across Raid's teeth. The sound was oddly pretty.
Fuck.
Raid spit blood onto the floor. Childers, impressed with her own speed, slashed again. This time, the scalpel didn't clear the space, however, because Raid put a bullet in Childers' gut. Childers stumbled backward into a row of file cabinets. She was stunned, surprised to see the quickly spreading stain of gore soaking her t-shirt. The light in the room appeared to quickly fade, retreating like a film reel in reverse. As everything darkened and the sounds of the room dampened to a fuzzy mush, Childers glanced at Dr. Song. She couldn't see his face clearly, but she could tell he was panicked. Brandon was crying. Childers's last thought was simple. It would be nice to see the sunrise right now. Holding his bleeding cheek, Raid pointed the gun at Dr. Song.
Does the fucking solution work?
Dr. Song nodded before pointing to Ashanik.
I don't know how. Ask Dr. Tyrael.
Raid turned to Ashanik and narrowed his eyes.
Then, he chuckled. Okay, you tell me.
Put the gun away first. Raid walked up to Matilda and pressed the muzzle of the Sig Sauer against her forehead.
Tell me, now.
Ashanik said,
It restructures the suppression system in the hippocampus. The first tests at Project Clarity, they activated cell regeneration on an expanded rate, one that led to increased neural connections along older, abandoned pathways. But the generation of these new networks didn't stop there. With the null, novel neural root systems appeared. Those are the source of the memories. I don't know how exactly they are coded, but they're in the junk DNA. The process my grandmother developed clips the newly developed neural root system, like yanking a weed from your lawn. When you undergo the process, it will remove all your genetic memories.
And new memories?
Shouldn't be affected. This is targeted.
that's the brilliance of it.
Ray dragged Matilda over to Arsenic. What if the head gets this? Can they do what they want the first time?
Maybe, Arsenic said. With certain modifications, it could work. For those who aren't null, and we don't actually know what percentage that could be, the revised procedure would likely suppress the hippocampus's activity to the point that we could rewrite the memory there.
The answer is yes,
Raid says.
With some qualifications, yes.
So Dr. Sykes lied to me.
Raid pulled the gun away from Matilda's head. He turned to look at the Linux machine humming in the corner, then glanced over at Childress's corpse. A pool of blood congealed under her chest, sticking her clothes to the floor.
The police will be here soon, 19,
Dr. Song said.
My name is Raid. 19 doesn't exist anymore. And there is no one coming to save you here. We own the police.
You don't own me, Kodo said. Raid shrugged.
You're nobody.
Raid, Arsenic said. I know what was done to you was unconscionable, that the memories awakened were horrific. But you can be fixed. They can be erased. I want to show you, but first, you need to let these people go. They don't have anything to do with it anymore. Just you and me. We'll fix you.
Raid shifted his gaze to Kodo and Brandon. The boy was sobbing. Raid considered putting a hole in the boy's stomach and watching his expression as the pain seized him. He decided against it.
Everyone group together, Raid said, motioning with the gun. Knee to knee, arms intertwine. I see any of you move. I will shoot the children first. Understand?
Raid let Matilda go. She walked over to Dr. Song and together they sat down beside Kodo. Matilda linked elbows with Arsenic and Kodo. Kodo then wrapped his arms around Brandon.
Keep your head down,
Kodo whispered to his son.
Just keep your eyes on the floor, okay? We're going to stay real still, and we'll be fine.
Moving the gun hand to hand, Ray took off his blood-soaked hoodie and the white tank top underneath. While the slice in his cheek had clotted, the red streaks of dribbled blood ran down his neck, across his chest and ribs, to his waist.
Don't fuck this up.
Raid sat cross-legged on the floor beneath the linic. He trained the gun on Brandon. His hand was perfectly still, his eyes as sharp as acacia thorns.
Go ahead, doctor.
Rattling sounds pinged around the room as the linic started up. The racket sounded as though someone had dumped all their loose change into a dryer and run it on high. The clanging was thankfully short-lived, however, only seconds in duration. As the linic moved into position over Raid's head, it angled downward in a smooth, silent motion. The room filled with an anxious energy as the air pressure fell. As the linic quieted, Arsenic said,
We tried to save you before, Raid. I'm sorry you're still so scared and so hurt.
The linic fired. The 6 hour dropped to the floor as Raid fell forward, convulsing. 62. 5:25 p.m., January 19, 1980, Three Saints Bay, Kodiak Island, Alaska. A blizzard roars over the Three Saints Bay facility. 5 inches have fallen in the past 47 minutes, and the lights inside the base flicker as the generators are strained. The hallways are empty, the staircases as well. The soldier manning the desk at the entrance doesn't play cards. He doesn't clean his gun or thumb through the stiff-page girly magazine that Morton stashed under the file folders in the desk's bottom drawer. Instead, he sits and listens to the storm grinding its way across the invisible landscape beyond the walls. He thinks back to being a child in Louisiana and hearing the relentless reverberation of hurricanes. In the central housing unit, the experimental subjects' doors are all shut. They are silent inside their rooms. Some of the orphans sleep, too drugged out and delirious to hear the blizzard overhead. Others lie idly in their beds,
staring at their nails or chewing on their hair. Waiting, always waiting. The Null, however, sit with their ears to the steel doors of their cells. Each and every one. They are ready. In the medical unit, Dr. Song and Dr. Sykes perform an autopsy. 33 died during one of the aerobic sessions on a treadmill. She was 15 and appeared fit. The records indicate that she was taken from an orphanage in Taos, New Mexico. 33 was Latina and quite short. Dr. Sykes is convinced she had an underlying heart condition, one that Dr. Song should have picked up on right after they recruited her. As Dorothy removes 33's heart, she turns the bruised raw organ around in the antiseptic light. Nothing evident.
3 treatment failures in 3 weeks,
Dr. Song says, his mouth hidden by his medical mask. He keeps his eyes on the corpse.
I'm worried we're pushing.
More will die, Dorothy says. They will keep dying until we get what we want. Did Joe Corin at Duke stop after he lost a couple subjects? Absolutely not. And he sure as hell got a lot closer than we have. If Dr. Tyrrell thought she was saving these wretches from suffering by tossing herself into the ocean, she was sorely mistaken. Dr. Song looks up to meet Dorothy's gaze. Get Janelle ready. All of this is heard by Subject 19. He sits in his cell ear to the door, just like the other Null. 19 is an 18-year-old boy, his thin frame lost in the bagginess of his boiler suit. His name is Raid Gavrilovic. Unlike most of the orphans, he remembers his parents. He vividly recalls the alcoholism and abuse, and he remembers the day he was taken. It was the first and only time his mother, high on methamphetamines and reeking of cheap liquor, had taken him to the playground in the park near their apartment. She dozed off on a bench while he played on the jungle gym. There were no other children. It was the middle of the day on a Wednesday. He played for only 20 minutes before the soldiers came. They gave his mother cash. He couldn't see how much. And then led him to a waiting car. That was it. When Raid hears the door to Janelle's cell open, he is ready. He digs at the thick callus on his left heel. The skin is white there, as hard and white as the snow pummeling the world above. 2 days ago, as soldiers were escorting Raid from the medical center, he stepped on a hypodermic needle. He did not cry out. He did not even limp. Raid knew he needed to keep that needle in his flesh. It was a key. Though the pain is delicious, and his bloody fingers have trouble grasping the end of the needle, he manages to pull it from his heel. Raid uses it to unlock his cell door. Unlike some of the other Null, his past life memories include many thieves. There was once a blacksmith, an African man who plied his trade in 18th century Paris. He was good at locks, and Raid remembers exactly how they were constructed. The technology hasn't really changed. Using the needle, it takes him 37 seconds. The door swings open. Outside, the main room is empty. Ignoring his bleeding foot and knowing that it will only be a matter of seconds before the soldiers watching the closed-circuit televisions upstairs see him, Raid scrambles to the cell next to his. He unlocks it, opens the door, and slips inside. A 10-year-old girl with bruised eyes sits on her cot. She is 18, and that is all is known about her.
Time to go, Raid tells her.
Together, they run out of the room, bare feet slapping the concrete floor. They run across the main floor to the hallway opposite, just as a soldier comes barreling in. Raid is on him faster than he can pull his sidearm. The soldier, only 10 years older than Raid, has a face blurred by acne. He screams when Raid plunges the hypodermic needle into his right ear. The drum bursts. Raid gets the soldier's gun and shoots him in the chest, then shoots him again in the back of the head.
We have 2 minutes, Raid says, handing the gun to 18.
She gets into position, gun outstretched, both hands on the grip, as Raid makes his way to the other cells. He unlocks as many of the Null as he can. 22, 23, 30. Then back to 15 and 10. By the time the hallway just outside the main room fills with the tumbling crash of boots, Raid has freed 24 of the experimental subjects. They all have a role to play in what happens next.
Hurry!
18 shouts. As the first soldier runs in, 18 drops him with a shot to the forehead. Raid wrenches a fire axe from the wall outside cell number 40. He uses it to gut a soldier as he stumbles down the stairs into the main room. Raid slides the axe to another null and grabs the soldier's semi-automatic weapons. He opens fire as another two soldiers run into the room. Their blood sprays across the faces of the panicked scientists who scramble into the room behind them. One of the null orphans smashes the butt of an assault rifle into a steam duct. The main room fills with billowing miasma of steam as more soldiers and scientists rush inside, all of them screaming. Everyone is engulfed in hot fog. Raid's memory of what happens next is piecemeal. As soldiers materialize from the room, he shoots them. Every adult face he sees, he blasts. They fall away, their blood spatters mingling with the mist. As he moves, he comes across numerous tableaux of violence. An orphan hacking off a scientist's head here. A soldier shooting a null subject in the face there. Raid finds 42 in the fog. He has two access badges and hands one to Raid.
This is it!
42 screams before a bullet severs his vocal cords. Raid runs with the ID badge to the first in a series of locked doors. He swipes the badge and the door opens. He's not thinking while he does this. He's not wondering when they're going to shut the whole place down. Maybe pull the plug on the power, or set off the sprinkler system, or just shoot up the hallways. Raid moves on instinct, driven more by a million years of neural activity surging through his brain. He isn't running down these hallways, leaving bloody soldiers and doctors in his wake as a boy. He's doing it as everyone who came before him. He's killing Asteria. He's running as a Trojan warrior. This moment, this bloodthirsty now, is the first time that Raid recognizes his own ascendancy. He knows he is better than every throat he cuts. As Raid and 40 run through the third set of doors, they pass a room where Janelle lies bruised and bloodied on a folding cart. Raid stops and helps her up. She's barely conscious, her left eye bruised shut. Dorothy has been frustrated. She's lashed out at Janelle, but never struck her directly. Apparently, Raid thinks, that has changed.
We need to go now,
40 yells. Raid helps Janelle navigate a series of stairs and narrow hallways before they are joined by a mob of the null subjects on the ground floor of the facility. 20 strong, they kick down a supply room door and grab every available coat, hat, and pair of gloves that they can find. Someone, maybe 16, tells the group that there are rafts with outdoor motors a half a mile from the facility. She overheard two soldiers say they're moored to a dock and never guarded. The mob, dressed for the cold, streams through the final set of doors. Morton and Phillips are waiting there, guns at the ready. They don't warn the orphans that they're going to open fire. They just do. The guns chatter and their bullets rip through the first five null subjects. Blood sprays across Janelle's face. She tastes it. But the group surges forward, unstoppable. Morton goes down first and is torn apart. Phillips mercifully takes an axe to the neck. In the chaos, Seven, one of the oldest null boys, a Hmong kid everyone calls Vang, though no one knows if that's his actual name, is hit in the face with the butt of a rifle. It's an accident. He's delirious and blood oozes from his nose. 22 grabs him and helps him up. The door to the outside is opened, and snow blasts inside. It swirls in blinding clouds across the faces of the null subjects. They run into it, gleeful, laughing. Yards from freedom, 40 is shot in the leg. She falls. Raid runs back to her. Janelle stops and yells for Raid to get up.
Come on! We have to go now! This is our only chance!
Raid glances back at 40, struggling to staunch the wound in her calf. He turns and looks past Janelle at the night landscape behind her. The snow drifts as tall as houses, the towering pine trees bent near sideways. He drops the gun in his hand. He drops the needle in the other. Janelle shakes her head before she's pulled out into the night by one of the other escapees. She vanishes into the winter blur. Raid spins around to help 40 up, but one of the soldiers is already there. He shoots her in the forehead, and Forty's blood sprays in a perfect arc across Raid's bare feet. The warm blood drenches his toes and makes it look like he's wearing red socks. That is when the memory fades. It disassembles like wet gauze. Raid watches as Forty's body dissolves into the floor, and then the floor dissolves as well. He is suddenly no longer in the head facility, but in a street. There are people marching around him, waving banners lit by torchlight. They are washed away, fading like overexposed photographs. The marchers step into shadows and never reappear. The memory is gone. Raid is in Russia. He sees himself in a mirror. He is Daria, but only for a second. Her face fades away. The mirror becomes shadow. The memory is lost. Raid is in a forest drinking from a stream. His hands chapped, and the sound of fire rushing overhead. It goes too. 1,000 lives slip past him. 1,000 lives evaporate until... 63. 9:39 p.m., November 15, 2018. Jesse Brown VA Medical Center, Chicago, Illinois. Raid woke up to find he was bound with computer cable. Kojo stood over him, the Sig Sauer in his right hand. Only a few minutes had passed. Raid said, "It worked." He heard the words come out of his mouth, but he wasn't certain what exactly he meant by them. Raid searched his mind, gathering up crumbling lumps of memory, but they fell apart before he could get a clear look at them. All that was left were sensations. Running, hurting, fear. Now, the furthest back his memory went was a decade, but instead of being filtered through the rage and pain, it was focused, like a spotlight tightened down to a pinpoint. It was just as bright, just as powerful, but not burdened by all the residue of the past. Raid had been working his way toward ascension, pulling every hair from his body, scrubbing his skin free of useless cells, and clearing his mind of base contemplations. He had been engaged in a never-ending series of skirmishes, taking ground slowly, inch by neural inch. Up until that moment, staring up at Kojo's fierce eyes, Raid was ready to continue that fight, and win, on his own personal terms. But the solution gave him a weapon he could never have imagined, an atomic bomb of simplicity. Erasing his mind, breaking the bonds of all those other lives, finally, truly made him perfect. "They're gone," Raid said. "You understand?" Raid rolled onto his side and looked over at Ashenig. "It worked. The memories are gone. Let me go now."
"Why?"
"I can stop the head. I know where they are." Ashenik turned to Kojo.
"Fuck that," Kojo said. He glanced across the room at Matilda. She sat beside Brandon. He was calm but clearly desperate to leave.
"We need to hurry, Ashenik," Dr. Song said. "The machine is ready."
"Ashenik." Matilda took the girl's hand. "I'm not like the others," Ashenik said. "I don't need the capsules. You've been so sick. The meds work. They don't. I've been pretending to take them. I put them in my mouth and leave them behind my teeth. Then, when no one's looking, I spit them out, usually into my hand where they crumble, and I just drop the dust."
"Why?"
Dr. Song says.
Raid laughed.
"Dr. Song is wrong, Matilda. I'm different. The machine only fixes people damaged by the tests, by the experiments. Not me. I was born this way. If I just have the time, I can integrate the memories. Maybe my mother, maybe Raid, they weren't ready. But I'm ready. Don't you see what this is?"
Matilda shook her head.
Ashenik said, "I am everyone who came before me, just like all of us are. Only I've been given a gift, a way to see into those souls. Please, Matilda, let me use this gift. I can change the world with it. If I go into that machine, it ends."
Matilda read Ashanik's face, her eyes. Every micro-expression, the lifting of her eyebrows, the curl of her lips, told Matilda that Ashanik was in complete and utter control. All of the subconscious tells had been erased. Matilda had never seen a face as perfectly at peace. There was no internal conflict, no suppression of emotion.
"Do you believe me?"
the girl asked. Matilda could see Ashanik was reading as well. Matilda felt naked, her soul exposed. There was nothing she could hide from Ashanik's eyes. Matilda simply nodded. Ashanik turned to Kojo.
"Untie him."
"You don't know what you're saying. He's a killer."
Raid scooted closer to Kojo so that he was at the detective's feet. Kojo backed up and put both hands on the gun.
"No one else can stop this," Raid said. "You have no idea how much money and power are wrapped up in this thing. If a single document leaks, entire branches of government will be wiped out overnight. If you bring it to the press, if you drag the machine out of this room and have Ashanik and me testify, nothing happens. There will be no investigation, because there can be no investigation. Let me be your tool. Let me be your weapon."
Ashanik pushed Kojo's gun down. He let her.
"This is crazy," Kojo said.
"This ends tonight,"
Ashanik replied. She pulled the scalpel from Childers's dead grip and used it to cut through the ties on Raid's hands. As he sat up, rubbing the chafed skin on his wrists, Ashanik placed a hand on his shoulder. He shuddered under her touch.
"It isn't true," she said. "My mom would have never abandoned you or 40.
Raid looked up at her, confused.
"I have no idea what you're talking about."
64. 11:04 p.m., November 15, 2018. Chicago Police Department, Homicide Division, Chicago, Illinois. Matilda sat alone in an interview room. It was small, with a little half desk that was stuck to one wall. The walls themselves were pale yellow in color, and the overhead lighting made everything look washed out, like the tanned paper around the pictures in Lucy's photo albums. Matilda had been in this room for over an hour. She knew Ashanik was in another room, Dr. Song in a third. When they'd first arrived at the station, there was a brief interview with a detective. He mentioned he was a friend of Kojo's, but walked that back a few seconds later, realizing he'd made a mistake. No one else had come in since. Matilda noticed a bruise on her right arm. It was in the shape of a human hand, fingers outstretched. She'd gotten it at the VA hospital. Seconds after Raid slipped out of the Linux room, the door was kicked open and SWAT officers stormed in. Matilda held hands with Ashanik as they both got down on their knees. She didn't hear the shouted orders, at least not that she could remember, but her body heard. Letting go of Ashanik's hand, Matilda threaded her fingers over her head. She closed her eyes and loosened her limbs as the cuffs went on. The half hour that followed was a tumult. She'd been pushed into the back of a squad car, dragged back out, and then hustled into the department before being tossed into the interview room. Alone with herself for the first time in days, Matilda was desperate for another person's presence. 8 minutes later, Kojo walked in. Matilda couldn't help but jump up and hug him. She felt her eyes tear up and wiped them prophylactically. Kojo felt so solid, the weight of him grounding her. She never wanted to let him go.
"It's okay," Kojo said. "We're okay. I had a friend switch the cameras off before I came in here. We have a couple of minutes before they figure it out and my ass is hauled out. So let me talk first, and then you can ask me a question if there's time."
Matilda nodded.
"These people Raid worked for, the head, they're going to try and bury us. We've got to go underground. FBI is already here. I can't trust anyone in the department, we already know that. I can get you and Ashanik out, though. But you can't go home. Ever. Understand?"
Matilda nodded again. tears rolling down her face to her chin.
I've got a place for you to go. It's not long term, but it'll be safe for a while. You'll fly out tonight.
How is Brandon?
Kojo said. He's all right. Gonna take a long time to recover from this, though. There are a couple of psychologists in with him. They haven't told him about... Oh, man. Officers found Ophelia at my place. She survived, but she's gonna have a long road to recovery. I'm not sure when Brandon can know that. He's a strong kid, though. You saw it, you know.
He is, like his dad. How's Ashanique?
You're not going to be shocked to hear this, but she's doing surprisingly well. They have a few people in there, people that I know. Psychologists walk out shaking their heads. Can't believe how smart she is. How tough. I think she's going to be fine.
Kojo held Matilda in silence for a second.
Here's the thing, he said. I'm not going to pretend that I get exactly what went down. Dr. Song can show me papers and explain it all till he's out of breath. But there's one thing that I can't make sense of. I get the genetic memory piece. I get the experiment. What I don't get is how Ashanique remembers that World War I.
George.
Yes, George. How can she remember his death?
Matilda wiped her nose and pulled far away to look Kojo in the eyes. She did not, however, let go. I've been thinking about that too, she said. I think Ashanique already told us the answer. We just... Well, I just didn't want to hear it. Maybe I'm shell-shocked. Definitely sleep-deprived. Beyond exhausted, really. But I think it's that we're all one. All part of a single... God damn, this sounds silly.
Go on. Nothing else makes sense.
Matilda said, there's this thing I remember from college. They say that all matter can't ever truly be destroyed. Every particle that exists has always existed. It takes on new forms, passing from one to the other. It's a plant, then inside a cow, then a person, then back to the soil. What if human consciousness can affect that process? What if we can influence it? We know that Ashanique and the other Null can remember their ancestors' lives. It's coded in their bodies. But maybe they can also remember other people's lives.
Okay, how?
Matilda thought back to when she and Ashanique were in the cab. Ashanique had cried, thinking of the beauty she'd seen, the splendor at the heart of being a Null. The collective unconscious is real. I don't know how they're stored. I don't know how they're transferred. But George's memories, his very last moments, wound up inside Ashanique. They're probably inside all of us. She and the other Null can access them. Maybe it's something quantum. But the only way it makes sense is if we're just like she said. We're more than disparate individuals. We're all connected in a collective and shared neural history. Humanity has a source code, and Ashanique's found a way to tap into it. Matilda took Kojo's hands and held them tight. She's the first, Matilda said, her voice charged with astonishment. Kojo whispered, feeling a sudden solemnity.
First of what?
Something remarkable. 65. 11:16 p.m., November 15, 2018. Human Ecology Division International Headquarters, Oswego, Illinois. Raid pulled a new hoodie over a bulletproof vest. Standing outside his rental car in the head parking lot, he laced up the Nike blazers he'd picked up at a mall in Aurora. They looked good in the sodium lights. It was late on Thursday night, and there were only 17 cars in the lot. Raid knew each and every one. He was there to kill their owners. As Raid crossed the lot, he slipped on his wireless headphones. He'd already prepped Philip Glass's Island and turned it up as loud as it would go. The song was his driving music. When he listened to it, he saw all sorts of swirling colors in the corner of his vision, ribbon-thin spirals of red and gold, slowly unwinding, spinning out into infinity. He considered the synesthesia another manifestation of his perfection, a sign that his brain had moved into a different gear. Despite what he'd read online in New Agey scientific journals with names like Advancement in Human Achievement and Journal of the Mind-Body Praxis, he did not consider himself a more advanced human. In Rait's mind, there was no further evolution to be had in the human form. He was greater because he simply wasn't human. And the head was where he would demonstrate it.
You are finally ready now.
The Human Ecology Division building was a low-slung, two-level brick affair that wouldn't have looked out of place in the pages of a magazine extolling the virtues of mid-century modern architecture. It was built in the mid-50s and intended to be utilitarian. Originally purposed as a school, it was remodeled in the 1970s as a research facility for the Army Corps of Engineers. The Human Ecology Division, flush with renewed CIA funds, moved into the building in 1985. Though the organization's various bureaucrats had all tried to put their marks on the place, breaking up the floors and adding a spiral staircase in 1990, installing a sleek modern lobby in 2006, the building had never lost its rather banal, practical look. Rait walked into that sleek lobby and tossed a grenade. It bounced behind the receptionist's desk and rolled to the older man's feet before it exploded into a tarry fireball. The alarms went off. Sprinklers followed. Rait pulled both of his Glocks from his track pants and started shooting. The first people he encountered were the three security guards on duty. Though they had nothing to do with Project Clarity, likely hadn't even been born when he escaped the facility, he knew they'd die. If he didn't kill them here, quickly, they would die when the CIA sweeper unit came through. Even though it had a building and a parking lot, the head was a place that didn't technically exist. When it burned, everyone in it would burn too. He shot the men as they rounded a corner, radio squawking in panic. Rait had brought 15 grenades. He tossed one into each lab he passed. By the time he was on the second floor, he'd thrown 10 grenades, and despite the sprinkler system, smoke choked the hallways. Rait had killed 8 scientists. Some of them were new. Some he'd seen in video conferences. 2 of them, assistants to Dr. Sykes in the late 1970s, actually recognized him. They were smart enough to know not to try and fight back. Both of them closed their eyes before he put an 8mm round in their heads. At the north end of the building, Rait tossed 2 grenades on the spiral staircases after he ascended it. He actually waited to see the damage they did. The staircase shuddered, its lower half falling away first. He was coated in drywall dust and wondered how many carcinogens he'd inhaled. As the last piece of shattered, steaming hot metal pinged against the linoleum floor, Rait took a long, deep breath. The smell reminded him of something, though he wasn't sure what it was. A memory teasingly played its fingers along the base of his brain, tickling like a failing sparkler. That was when someone stabbed Rait in the back with a pair of scissors. He felt them go in deep, ripping through his hoodie, cutting through one of the vest straps, before it plunged through his left trapezius muscle. One of the blades chipped his spine. He didn't need to see it to know it was one of those heavy-duty scissors, the metal ones with the painted black handles. Rait turned to see a cowering scientist in a lab coat. The man was young, maybe late 20s, and he actually mouthed sorry as he backed away, hands raised. Rait shot him in the nose. He continued on, inhaling too much smoke, feeling the sooty deposits building up in his lungs, and wondering if he should have brought a respirator.
No time for that now. No time for second guessing.
Rait tossed his last grenades into 2 rooms thrumming with computers. He also threw in the Glocks before he stopped at Dr. Sykes's office door. He had decided earlier in the evening that he wasn't going to shoot her. He had other plans. Dr. Sykes's door was locked, so he casually knocked. Dorothy opened the door with a Colt revolver. She fired twice before Rait smacked the gun from her hand. One bullet hit the vest, and the vest did its job. The second hit him in the neck. He felt the instant warmth of an arterial gush as the blood burbled out and poured down his side, under his vest, and into his pants, where it was wicked up. Raid clamped his left hand down on his wound, but he knew he had only minutes before he bled out. Dorothy considered herself a perceptive person. She spent 40 years in biomedical research, to the detriment of every aspect of her life. 4 years of medical school, a residency in surgery, another in neurology, then 4 years for the PhD in biochemistry. She was not a stupid person. But she'd also left behind 2 failed marriages, 3 children who hated her, children she hadn't seen in nearly a decade, and lived in a small apartment with no artwork. As she backed away from Raid, his face paling by the second from blood loss, she couldn't help but think of the fact that she used to love art. In school, when life was simple and seemed so full of meaning and purpose, she would go to the Art Institute and stare at the post-impressionist paintings, losing herself in their vivid colors. At the time, nearly 30 years ago, she imagined they perfectly captured the swirling complexity of the human brain's neural network. Cheesy, yes, but on point. She hadn't had time to look at art or even think about it since then. Funnily enough, Dorothy couldn't help but see the contrast of Raid's bright red arterial blood against his pale skin and think, it's kind of pretty.
You lied to me,
Raid gurgled. I never lied. The machine didn't.
Not the machine.
Dorothy moved behind her desk. Her eyes scanned across the papers and laptops, looking for anything sharp. She just needed to keep him at arm's length for another 1 minute and 30 seconds or so. He was bleeding out bad. God damn, Dorothy thought. Going to the shooting range on weekends actually paid off. This fucker's just failed. Then what, Raid?
I never, ever lied. They left you behind, remember? No.
I trained you. I showed you how to learn from the memories, how to mine them for skills. That ruthlessness, that cunning, I gave it to you. For 20 years we've been a team and I never let you. Raid suddenly lurched forward with an unexpected burst of strength and kicked the desk, pinning Dorothy against the wall. Textbooks tumbled from a bookshelf, pages coming loose and floating about. The door to the hallway still open, smoke poured into the room, clouding the ceiling. Dorothy could hear sirens outside. This is almost over. Hang on.
About what we are,
Raid clarified. I don't understand. What? Raid spat a wad of phlegmy clotted blood onto the desk, clearing his throat.
Gnolls aren't freaks. The machine didn't activate old nerves. It plugged us in.
Raid could feel his body slipping. He kicked the desk again, crunching Dorothy harder against the wall. The smoke spilled in faster.
Plugged you into what? Dorothy asked between gritted teeth. The rest of us,
Raid said, delirious now.
We are Legion.
Raid coughed, the blood spurting wildly from between his fingers. Dorothy saw her moment and pushed the desk back against him. Raid stumbled backward but caught himself on her lab coat with his filthy, blood-coated right hand. Dorothy grabbed at his hand to wrench it off. In the corner of his vision, he saw fire trucks and cops pulling up outside. He could feel her body tensing. He figured she was considering jumping. From the room's height, she might break a leg, but it must have seemed worth a chance. It was only 30 feet, and there were bushes just below the window. People have certainly survived a hell of a lot worse. Holding onto her lab coat as tight as he could, he freed his left hand and, stretching as far as he could, snagged Dorothy's Aurora fountain pen from her breast pocket. She stared at him befuddled as he ripped the cap off with his teeth. Dorothy clearly didn't realize what he was doing until he did it.
You end here,
Raid said. With a final burst of vigor, the very last ounce he possessed, he dragged her down and slammed the tip of the Aurora pen into Dorothy's right eye. It pierced deep, cutting through the gelatinous vitreous body before cutting through the optic nerve and shredding the blood vessels. Dorothy fell backward against the wall screaming as Raid tumbled back in the opposite direction. He hit the floor and found fire. As the quickly spreading flames licked the clothing from his body, Raid realized that this was the moment he'd been preparing for. He was transforming.
Embrace it. Embrace the conversion.
All the animal skin peeled away. The heavy, burdensome bones fractured and the marrow steamed, his organs boiled, and then, as the last few pulses of bioelectrical energy crossed his synaptic junctions, Raid became a being of light and ash. 66. 3:26 p.m., February 15, 1912. Kobdo Territory, Independent Outer Mongolia. An old woman makes her way up a winding path that coils across the face of a mountain. The clouds eddy in the valleys below her. She is dressed in colorful woven fabrics and moves slowly, relying on walking sticks to help her over obstacles, like tree roots and stones. She glances up at the top of the mountain, where a monastery sits. The old woman has been walking for 5 days. She takes 2 breaks a day, one in mid-morning when the sun casts short shadows, and once in the early evening. She does not eat much. Some dried meats and nuts, and her legs are strong. The old woman has been walking for most of her 62 years. She doesn't believe in riding horses or sitting in the backs of wagons. Her feet will get her where she needs to go. And already, the world is moving far too fast. The old woman reaches the monastery, late in the day. The sun sets over the mountains at her back, bathing them blood red. She pauses a moment to look out over the valley through which she's walked. The old woman recalls the path, the muddy creek she forded, the antelope bounding in twitchy anxiety over stubbled hills. As with all the journeys she's taken, she sees the beauty in the process. The old woman turns and opens the wooden door to the stone monastery and steps inside to see monks in supplication. They look like puddles of orange, still and silent, on the stone floor. She makes her way down the aisle between them to the abbot at the front of the sanctuary. Seeing her approach, he rises and takes her hand.
Mother, he says, it has been so long. I was worried you would never allow me to see you again.
She nods as she fights back tears.
Many cruel things were said,
the old woman whispers.
I have forgiven them.
Together, they walk carefully up a narrow flight of stairs to the roof.
How are his pains?
The old woman asks.
They come and go. There has been only mild pain today. And it is in the stomach, as well as the legs.
The old woman is silent as she considers this.
Does that worry you, Mother?
He is also my son. All of it worries me.
They reach the roof and step out on the ceiling of heaven. The view from there is stunning. The whole of the world below is spread out at their feet. The abbot escorts his mother to a monk lying on a platform. She sits down beside the monk as the abbot chants prayers. The old woman pulls several small cloth bags filled with cinnabar, mercury sulfide, and dried herbs from a satchel. Unrolling several strips of eating paper, digestible rice paper with magical incantations written on them, the old woman feeds them to the ill monk before she takes her son's hands, the monk's and the abbot's.
It's so good to see you both again. Yes, Mother. Anger has made us ill. It is over now.
The abbot and his medicine woman mother bow their heads in prayer as the ill monk opens his eyes to see the sweep of the sun overhead. He grips his mother's hand as tightly as he can and weeps. 67. 7:31 a.m., February 29, 2019, just outside of Story, Wyoming. Ashanik's eyes fluttered open. For a second, she wasn't sure where she was, but she knew she was safe. Ashanik sat up. She was in bed, a twin with a down blanket and a folded quilt on the end. Sunlight poured through the window opposite, illuminating a small bedroom with late morning light. The closet door was open and she could see new clothes hanging inside. On the left seat was a backpack, also new. Arshanik got out of bed, pulled on a sweater, and made her way to the kitchen. The smell of coffee and toast quickened her step. The house was a two-story and barely decorated. Some leftover art, mostly landscapes owned by the previous tenants, dotted the walls. As Arshanik ran down the stairs, she caught sight of snow-peaked mountains through the windows. They were visible only briefly before towering pine trees blocked the view. Good morning. Arshanik found Matilda in the kitchen. She'd cut her hair short and dyed it red. She sat at the kitchen table, another leftover, sipping coffee, a laptop open in front of her. Arshanik saw Matilda was talking to Kojo on a secure video call. He was sitting in his living room. Brandon was in the background singing. The boy walked into view and waved when he noticed Arshanik. She leaned in and blew a kiss.
How are you, Ash?
Kojo asked.
Good. Slept in, though. Makes me kind of wonky.
You enjoying school?
Arshanik shrugged.
It's school.
She waved goodbye and walked across the small kitchen to pour herself a cup of coffee. Matilda watched her, then looked back at Kojo.
So, two new Knoll kids will be coming by next week, she said. They're twins, 13 years old. Mom is number 27. She died 2 years back, and they've been in foster care ever since. We'll see what we can learn.
How the hell did you find them?
With the head broken and Congress investigating, a lot of paperwork has made its way online. Dr. Song's been coordinating some of those releases, most via offshore leak sites, but at least it's out there. He was contacted by other survivors, people like Janice, people who spent the last 40-some years in hiding. They feel safe enough to reach out. The network is still active. Dr. Song's busier than ever, trying to get people where they need to be.
To the Linux machines.
Some of them, Matilda said. The original subjects who are still around.
And their kids?
Matilda smiled. They're mostly like Ash. They don't want to forget.
By the way, you look at the link I sent?
Yeah. It's all anonymized. Hard to say if it's real. Kojo leaned in, face closer to the camera.
Excited for our visit?
Of course. Matilda sipped her coffee. As she did, her bathrobe slipped off her shoulder, revealing a hint of pale skin and a curve of cleavage.
Hang on,
Kojo said as she straightened her bathrobe.
Got to let me at least enjoy the peak.
Stop it, you two, Arshanik said as she sat at the table. I need Matilda.
Fine, Kojo said. I'll call you two this afternoon.
Matilda smiled, puckered, then, don't forget.
I wouldn't.
And say bye to Brandon for me. Excited to see him.
He loves it up there.
Bye, babe. Kojo logged out and Matilda turned her attention to Arshanik.
Okay, she said. You've got another one, right?
You're going to love it. This is what, the 80th? Matilda smiled as she opened a program on the laptop and began recording.
So, she said, tell me about this life.
Arshanik began with the old woman's journey across the desert. She went into great detail, mostly about the feel of the dry air and the smells of the high mountain desert, painting a vivid picture before she described the touching reunion between the medicine mother and her sons. As she listened, Matilda glanced over Ashanik's shoulder to the window, just above the kitchen sink. There she could see the back of Lucy's head, as the old woman slowly rocked back and forth on the porch glider. Lucy's eyes were turned to the mountains and the bright sky beyond. Postscript. 68. 13:09:23 p.m. Intense device.
There were more. You on?
Change status to away. 13:11:34 p.m. Change status to online. 13:15:09 p.m.
13:15:16 p.m. Null hype. Yes. 13:15:17 p.m. Null hype. Who is this? 13:15:21 p.m. Intense device. Alaska was the fifth site. I have a list. Hacked it after the fire. All systems down. 13:15:32 p.m. Null hype. What sites? 13:15:37 p.m. Null hype. Where is the list from? 13:15:42 p.m. Intense device. Don't believe me? 13:15:45 p.m. Intense device. Project Clarity. 13:15:48 p.m. Null hype. Hacked head? 13:15:51 p.m. Intense device. Yes. 10 sites total. I got files go back to 1960s and more. Things you don't know. Things you would never believe. Examples. 13:15:53 p.m. Intense device. Taos. 13:15:55 p.m. Intense device. Chattanooga. 13:15:56 p.m. Intense device. Miami. 13:15:58 p.m. Intense device. And Project Ministry. 13:15:59 p.m. Null hype. Who is this? 13:16:02 p.m. Null hype. Question mark. 13:16:05 p.m. Intense device. Raid wasn't alone. 13:16:06 p.m. Intense device. Lock your door. I'm coming. Change status to away. 13:16:08 p.m.
The Clarity, a novel, was written by Keith Thomas and read by Robin Eller. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Clarity, a novel, is available in print from Leopoldo and Company.